Today is Friday, May 22nd, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover how Washington walked away from the Trump-Xi summit, having adopted Beijing's preferred diplomatic language without locking in economic commitments, how Ukraine's seizure of Stepnohursk has collapsed Russia's primary offensive axis in Zaporizhia, and how the dismantlement of U.S. soft power architecture is creating durable strategic vacuums across the global south. The most consequential phrase to emerge from the Trump-Xi summit was not a threat, not a concession. It was a formulation, constructive relationship of strategic stability, on the basis of fairness and reciprocity. That language belongs to Xi Jinping. It reflects Beijing's preferred relational construct, and Washington adopted it wholesale within a single summit cycle. Ambassador Edgar Kagan, analyzing the summit on CSIS's China Power podcast hosted by Bonnie Lin, describes this as a meaningful precedent inversion and a structurally asymmetric outcome. The U.S. factsheet embraced Xi's framing. China's readouts, released significantly faster than Washington's two-day delay, were both more detailed and notably absent the specific economic commitments the U.S. cited. Boeing aircraft purchases, agricultural imports, beef market access restoration, and rare earth supply assurances. On rare earths specifically, the U.S. fact sheet states only that China will address U.S. concerns, a formulation Kagan describes as materially weaker than a bilateral commitment. The Chinese side, by releasing their version first, anchored international media interpretation before Washington's narrative even existed. The strategic calculus here is straightforward. Beijing achieved international legitimization of a relational construct it has long sought, preserved full flexibility on economic deliverables, and extracted ambiguous U.S. signals on Taiwan, all without making formal concessions. Washington, by contrast, anchored a diplomatic frame it will struggle to reverse. Kagan draws an explicit parallel to the Phase One trade deal of 2020, in which China agreed to large, specific purchase targets, soybeans, energy, manufactured goods, and subsequently failed to meet them in full. The current situation replicates that dynamic with less documentary foundation. There are no publicly confirmed volumes, no timelines, no accountability architecture. Building on that, the Taiwan dimension of the summit warrants particular attention. Trump's public emphasis on the 9,500 miles of geographic distance between the United States and Taiwan, framing conflict as unwanted, represents what Kagan assesses as an extremely unhelpful departure from the extended deterrence messaging that prior administrations of both parties carefully maintained. Notably, Beijing's Wang Yi was measured in how he characterized the outcome. His formulation was, "Our impression is that the U.S. does not support Taiwan independence, not a claim of formal U.S. agreement." That careful phrasing suggests the summit did not produce a fundamental Taiwan policy shift. But the deterrence optics of Trump's public commentary were registered sharply by regional allies. Kagan notes that Trump called Japanese Prime Minister Takeuchi and German Chancellor Merz from Air Force One while departing China, a reassurance signal. But structural questions about U.S. reliability on Taiwan persist and are accelerating independent deterrence hedging in Tokyo, Seoul, and Canberra. If specific economic purchase commitments fail to materialize within 30 to 60 days, the monitoring window Kagan identifies as critical, the U.S. will face an escalation dilemma without the documentary foundation that made Phase 1 noncompliance legible and actionable. And with reportedly 3 to 4 Trump-Xi meetings planned this year, the constructive strategic stability frame will be repeatedly reinforced as the bilateral baseline, progressively constraining U.S. negotiating posture in every subsequent engagement. While the diplomatic theater played out between Washington and Beijing, a more kinetic shift was registered on the ground in southern Ukraine. On May 18th, Ukraine's main intelligence directorate announced the completion of a special forces operation that fully overran Russian positions in Stepnohirsk, Zaporizhia Oblast. Commander Viktor Taraytuk of the Artin unit confirmed every building was cleared of enemy remnants and explosive devices. Ukrainian armor equipped with counter-drone cage systems advanced in coordinated columns supported by real-time drone reconnaissance. Forces destroyed a bridge into the settlement and established fire control over the single remaining eastern road. Russia's defensive response, according to available reporting, amounted to a single FPV drone detected and destroyed before impact. The strategic calculus here requires context. Russia had committed significant resources to holding Stepnohirsk for over a year. In December 2025, Moscow falsely claimed to have captured the settlement, a deliberate informational operation designed to generate diplomatic leverage ahead of peace talks. The sequential, documented liberation of those same settlements now dismantles that leverage entirely and provides Ukraine with an evidentiary record demonstrating a consistent pattern of Russian disinformation about territorial control directly relevant to any future third-party mediation. This result fits within a broader trend that the Institute for the Study of War documented on May 2, April 2026 produced Russia's first net territorial loss since the August 2024 Kursk incursion. That matters not just tactically but politically. Moscow had consistently deployed marginal monthly territorial gains as a domestic and informational tool, proof that the war's trajectory remained in Russia's favor. That tool is now gone. The shifting geography of power in this theater shows Ukraine executing what analysts are describing as active defense with selective counterattack, a posture bearing structural resemblance to the phase that preceded Ukraine's 2022 Kharkiv counteroffensive. The combined arms integration on display at Stepnohirsk, cage armored vehicles, drone reconnaissance, precision fires, systematic urban clearance, echoes the operational tempo of those earlier operations. Russia now faces a resource allocation dilemma with no clean solution. Prioritizing Donetsk, where a nominal early September deadline has been assessed by deputy head of the presidential office, Pavlo Polisa, as unachievable, starves Zaporizhia of the reserves needed to reconstitute defensive capacity. The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant remains within the oblast, held by Russia, constituting a structural constraint on escalation dynamics that warrants continuous monitoring. Any significant Ukrainian territorial advance toward the plant raises the probability of a nuclear safety crisis focal point, with consequences extending well beyond the bilateral conflict. Both of those developments, the summit's diplomatic asymmetry and Ukraine's battlefield gains, are unfolding against a backdrop of eroding U.S. soft power architecture that creates structural openings for state-backed competitors across the global south. Two distinct but linked developments illustrate this. The first is the DOGE-driven dismantlement of OSAID, described by participants in recent panel discussions as proceeding via AI-assisted contract review, followed by broad cancellations executed without strategic discrimination. Judicial action has partially reversed some of these cancellations, yet the overall federal budget impact appears limited. The more consequential and underappreciated dimension, per one participant with 10 years of USAID experience, is the earlier elimination of cabinet-level pandemic preparedness infrastructure and U.S. personnel stationed abroad for pathogen surveillance, a capability gap whose costs are asymmetric and deferred. The second development comes from the CSIS Future Summit on Commercial Diplomacy, where representatives of Cisco, Chevron, and ADM independently converged on the same structural diagnosis. Cisco Vice President Nicole Isaac stated it plainly: developing country governments and companies can receive financing from competitor development agencies while still inside the U.S. government's due diligence process. That is a structural first-mover disadvantage with compounding consequences given infrastructure lock-in effects. Once a government commits to a particular vendor's digital infrastructure standards, switching costs are prohibitive, and those standards shape data security and economic dependency for decades. The strategic calculus here is that the USA dismantlement and the commercial financing speed gap are not separate problems. They are two faces of the same institutional erosion. Companies like ADM, which operates in over 180 countries and trades approximately 5% of the world's commodities, explicitly leverage U.S. government-funded NGOs and agricultural research institutions as implementation partners. USAID retrenchment, therefore, does not merely reduce humanitarian programming. It undermines the enabling environment for U.S. commercial operations in precisely the markets where state-backed Chinese alternatives are competing most aggressively. The Cold War precedent is instructive. Where the U.S. successfully positioned private sector investment as the preferred alternative in Latin America and parts of Southeast Asia, it built durable commercial and diplomatic relationships. Where it failed to compete on speed or terms, parts of Africa and Central Asia, competitor influence proved sticky. The Huawei 5G displacement effort of 2018 to 2020 is the most direct recent parallel. The U.S. mobilized diplomatic and financial tools to offer alternative vendors to partner governments, with mixed results in which financing competitiveness and speed were the decisive variables. Isaac confirms those constraints remain structurally unresolved in 2026. Cisco's announcement of a partnership with Exim Bank on the African continent is a genuine test case for the public-private commercial diplomacy model. But individual deals do not address systemic competitive disadvantage. And the USAID did move toward tied aid, requiring commodities sourced from U.S. producers and transported via U.S.-flagged shipping, runs counter to established donor practice. Research by Clay, Benson, and Bott, along with related OECD studies, estimates tied food aid costs 30 to 50% more per beneficiary than locally procured alternatives. Both the UK in 2001 and Canada in 2008 formally untied their food aid and documented measurable cost-effectiveness improvements. The regression from that practice weakens soft power objectives while protecting domestic commercial constituencies, a trade-off rarely stated explicitly in policy documents. On NATO's eastern flank, the deterrence architecture is being stress-tested in ways that deserve direct attention. On May 18th, Lithuanian Foreign Minister Kęstutis Budrys publicly stated that NATO possesses the capability to raise Russian air defenses and missile bases in Kaliningrad, tying this capability explicitly to U.S. participation, and warning that European members would need to rethink everything, including nuclear deterrence, if U.S. critical enablers were withdrawn. This statement followed a Defense News report citing three unnamed U.S. officials that the Trump administration is preparing to reduce American contributions to the NATO force model, the standing Rapid Activation Force pool underpinning Alliance Collective Defense. The Suwalki Corridor, 65 kilometers connecting Poland and Lithuania, flanked by Kaliningrad to the west and Belarus to the east, remains the single most strategically fragile point on NATO's eastern flank. Budrys' statement is best understood as coordinated deterrence communication directed simultaneously at Moscow, at European alliance partners, and at Washington, making the cost of U.S. force reduction legible in concrete military terms. Russia's Kaliningrad garrison stands at an estimated 18,000 troops, supported by Baltic Fleet assets including approximately 52 surface vessels, missile systems, and Su-30, Su-27, and Su-24 aircraft. Belarus commenced a joint exercise with Russia on May 18th, rehearsing tactical nuclear weapon deployment from Belarusian territory. The nuclear dimension cannot be analytically separated from any conventional scenario in this theater. In the Western Hemisphere, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche announced that a grand jury in the Southern District of Florida returned an indictment on April 23rd charging Raul Castro with conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals, destruction of aircraft, and four individual counts of murder. Simultaneously, the USS Nimitz Carrier Strike Group entered Southcom's area of responsibility for Southern Seas 2026, a multilateral exercise involving Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Uruguay. Blanche's public statement, by his own will or by another way, echoes language from the Venezuela Maduro sequence, deliberately leaving coercive ambiguity about the means of bringing Castro to justice. The Noriega precedent, federal indictment in 1988 followed by military invasion in 1989, is the most direct structural antecedent. If a second successful forced rendition of a Western Hemisphere head of state occurs in close succession, it substantially rewrites the deterrence calculus for authoritarian governments throughout the region. The signal to monitor in the next 48 hours is the Belarusian force posture following the May 12th mobilization announcement. Observable force movements toward the Suwalki corridor, or the absence of such movements, will serve as the most immediate indicator of whether the joint Russian-Belarusian nuclear deployment exercise represents messaging or preparation. Combined with confirmation or denial of the Defense News report on U.S.-NATO force model reductions through official channels, this will be decisive for alliance credibility calculations across the Euro-Atlantic theater. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. We'll be back tomorrow with the next strategic update.